Why don't you come and join us and committee in order that they might get through? Because yesterday I intentionally wanted us to have that level of debate, Senator, that we did have, because I think that that was important. But today, what I want to have happen is that Mr. George will have a chance to finish the report and go through the performance measures, and then at the close of that, any questions, we can do that again, but at least let us get that far, because tomorrow is public hearing, and we start on public testimony. And then on Monday, we want to start with another portion of VHS. I think it's VR.
Yes.
Okay. So that we can kind of stay on schedule. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chair Carter and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ramona Foley. I'm Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services with Children, Adults, and Families. And we will just start right in with Mr. George to try to finish and complete the foster care portion. And then we also want to try to do the adoptions portion today as well.
Good afternoon, Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin George, and I work as a foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. I want to first pause and thank the committee for hearing our panel yesterday, especially the time you gave to the young woman who came in, Nicole, and talked about her experiences in foster care. It was very meaningful to her. We also had one point of clarification from yesterday in terms of we were talking about the numbers of children in family foster care, in that we, on an average daily basis, we have 7,734 currently, and that we alluded to a number of years ago in 2000. Year 2000, we had 6,185. So between 2000 and 2006, we've actually grown by an average daily population of 1,549 more children today on average than we did 5-6 years ago. So I wanted to make sure we had clarification on that. So I'm going to jump into, and I'm actually starting on page 101 of 158, and clarify again, just that we're talking about the numbers of children. When I say the average daily populations, that's if I went out today and counted noses, how many children would be in family foster care. But the reality is that a significant number of children actually experienced foster care in Oregon in a given year. And last year, we served over 16,000 children in foster care, at-home care arrangements. Of those children, we have 30.5% of them are actually placed with their relatives. And that number has been one that's been steady, although it is a slight increase this year from the year before. So the overall number of foster children in family foster care with relatives is 30.5%. We have an additional, as you read there, additional number of children, over 600 in residential treatment programs. And we are serving over 1,300 children through our independent living program. And again, that has continued to show steady increase over the last several years, of a 6.3 increase just this last year alone. In the performance measures, in the federal government will be out here again in the fall to review the state's child welfare system for the Child and Family Services Review. And there are four specific program outcomes that they look for in foster care as far as the out-of-home care. And the first one is length of time to achieve reunification. And you can see on page 102 that the definition of reunification is that of all the children who are reunified with their families, how often are we doing it within less than 12 months? So the national benchmark is 76.2% or more of the children should be reunified in 12 months. As you can see from the graphic below, we are not achieving that. In fact, we've slipped in the last year to even be at a slower rate. It's important to remember, though, that 64% of the children that come into foster care are returning home. So they are being reunified with their families. Just in Oregon, we have a different way of counting some of this information. And we look at the median months for all children. So of all the 5,000 children who left foster care last year, our average, our median number of months is 15. So we're just above what's being asked for as far as the 12.
Do you have performance measures toward this piece?
Yes, the performance measure is actually...
You can just identify it when you get there so we can know your success rate.
Carter, this is the performance measure here.
Oh, okay.
In terms of the length of time to reunification.
Okay, got it.
And on page 102, you see the chart, and we're trying to strive for that line. The primary indicator that we have can identify at this point in time is that one of the most critical areas for us is to try to serve our families is access to alcohol and drug treatment services. And we know that the sooner we can get the mother, the father, the family engaged in alcohol and drug treatment services, the more likely chances that they're going to be able to get in, get clean and sober if that's what needs to happen, and be able to get the children back home. So we know access to services specifically is a barrier. The next page actually talks about, of all those children that actually left the foster care system, where did they go? Again, I reiterate that 64% of the children actually were reunited with their families. Another, yes.
I want the committee to hear in consultation why when we get to the piece when you ask them for caseworkers, that's why you're asking them, you're tying it into this piece so that they can go much faster in getting these kids either reunified, reunified with families, but they can't do it with the level of workers that they have right now.
Correct, Chair Carter. Thank you very much for that clarification. So we talked about the children that actually be reunified. One of the things that when Ms. Foley talked yesterday about having the National Resource Center out here to review our programs, one of the things that they really identified is the length of time we have custody of children, legal custody of children, and having this DHS given legal custody of children from the court and then leaving them in their own home. Some go into foster care, and then after they go from foster care, they go back home. We still retain legal custody. And certainly from the National Resource Center's perspective, one of the things we need to do is really clarify what it is that we are providing that oversight on. So as a part of our program this year, we've also introduced House Bill 2181, which seeks to clarify the department's role in post-placement supervision. So once we have the child be reunified with family, we want the court to really help clarify for us our role and responsibility of being involved in that family, because we continue to be involved with that family for a period of time. And we've got a number of key concepts to our new safety model that we believe will address this, and we are working towards that. And it is about protective capacity assessment. And Ms. Swanson on Monday may have touched upon that. That's trying to really assess the family and the parents' ability to care for children safely and when it is time for the child to return home, as well as identifying conditions for return. So being very clear with families at the very get-go, what's it going to take for little Johnny to come back home? What we've tried to also provide you is a comparison to other states. Those questions have come before. How does Oregon compare to other states? As some of you know, we have the federal government's broken into regions, and in our region, the neighboring states tend to be in Washington, Idaho, Alaska. And we've added in Oklahoma merely from the standpoint that it's a state of similar size to us as far as child population, state-administered program, as far as another comparison out there. So you can see the comparison numbers.
Madam Chair? Senator Gordy, thank you very much. If I may just stop you just for a moment, going back to your example of little Johnny and little Johnny's parents and the parents' understanding of what it will take to bring little Johnny back home. Who's talking to little Johnny? And who's helping him understand the circumstances and what the expectations are?
Sure, Carter, Senator Gordy. Who's talking to Johnny is really is certainly the caseworker's responsibility to be doing that. And having that caseworker face-to-face contact clearly is the caseworker's responsibility. Depending on the age of the child and the court, we may also have a court-appointed service advocate, so a CASA assigned to that child. Their responsibility would also be help little Johnny understand that. Oftentimes, children may have attorneys. Their job is to help little Johnny understand that. And clearly, the best way little Johnny can understand that is if we're all giving the same messages to him about what it's going to take for him to go home.
Okay. The second, excuse me, George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you've considered also adding a performance measure around the reunification rate. I noticed in the last bullet, the reunification rate is the 64%. That's different than the length of time to reunification. What is the federal standard, and why are we below the federal standard? You've been talking about why we're not meeting the other one, so I assume it's the same reasons. I'm referring to the last bullet on top half of page 103.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, the national standard is set by how all states did in the first CFSR. So it's sort of an artificial target, but it means we would be doing as well as most other states if we're able to come in below that. What is interesting about this measure that we will then, as we segue into reentries, Oregon, on this table, is a bit slower to get kids back home, but their kids are also less likely to reenter than they are compared to other states. So some of these measures, you almost have to compare several measures together to kind of get a sense of how well the state is doing. And I think that was the next issue we're going to talk about. When you get to the chart at the top of 105, you'll see how much better Oregon does in terms of reentries. We have fewer children that have to actually come back into foster care. And that's an ongoing conversation with us and other states as we look at what are the practices that keep kids home safely, plus how can we expedite getting them back home. Certainly that's a role of the caseworker to spend that time with the family. The other policy package that you all will debate is the package around legal representation. That's very key in looking at what are the issues that got the child into foster care, what are the issues that we have to address in the law that get the child back out of foster care and back home.
Thank you. It's not quite a follow-up, but I just want to remember to ask about it. We talked about the percent of children being placed with a relative. This goes back to yesterday's conversation about what we're, you know, able to provide for relative foster parents. How do we compare nationally? It's 30.5% of our kids are going into relative care. Do we have a sense of average nationally? Because we're one of only a couple states that doesn't do the payment. I'm wondering if there's any correlation. Other states are able to place more with relatives because they actually provide. I'm just wondering if that's available.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek. That information is available if we go in and get other states' numbers, certainly. The challenge of it is trying to get into decipher exactly how it is that they measure. One of the things that the federal government has changed here recently is increasing the federal regulations on licensing of relatives. And what we have found over time, when they changed those regulations in 1999-2000, Oregon adopted those and we started certifying all of our relatives. We've also found that many other states made a different policy decision in their states, and what they chose to do was not license the relative and therefore not pay that relative, but still place the children with them under another methodology within their state. So the federal government has come back now and tightening those regulations up and requiring everybody to be licensed. If the state has legal custody of a child, they have to actually have them licensed. And so it's kind of a artificial number right now to really go and compare apples to grapes is kind of what we'd be doing at this point. But it is important to keep looking at the reunification back to families is very important in the overall outcome, but the number of relatives who are caring for children. We also have situations in states where they have made policy decisions around guardianship programs and being able to have relatives be able to get guardianship for children, and so then the state is not involved with those. They get legal guardianship, and then the family moves on.
One additional question. Do we have the rate for California? It's not displayed here. I'm curious. They have more of a cultural mix in California than the other states that are displayed here, what is the rate in California?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordon, we could absolutely provide that for you. The difference with California is that they're all county administered. So as their numbers roll up, it's hard to say what the state is. But in essence, they have a measure. They have gone through the CFSR, the Child and Family Service Review, like every other state. So we can certainly provide that to you on all four of these measures that I'm going to talk about.
Thank you.
So as Ms. Foley talked about, as far as foster care reentries, again, it's talking about those children that have actually gone home, how many of them come back in to care. And as you can see on that graph on page 104, the goal in this one is to be below the line, which Oregon is, and the comparison to other states. And when I've talked with my peers, foster care managers in at least Idaho and Washington, around, talk to me about your rate to reunify children, the first thing that came out of both of their mouths was, well, we send kids home fast, but they also come in fast. They're coming right back in the door. So they were trying to get information from me is, how do we make that decision to send the child home and they stay home at a much higher rate than they've got? So it is that learning from other states best practice. The next measure is incident of child abuse and neglect, and unfortunately, Senator Westland actually requested this information yesterday, so we'll have to brief him on it another time, is the number of children been abused in foster care. We provided on Monday a correction on this page, and I will point it out to you as we go, but it's looking for how many children were abused in a foster care, out-of-home care setting, at the benchmark, national benchmark being 0.57% or less. And as you can see, Oregon has hovered around that. We dipped under it, and now we've actually gone back up a little bit in this last year. And part of what we're continuing to challenge ourselves with is making sure, as the foster parent talked about yesterday, the complexity of the kids that are coming into their homes and the complexity of the behaviors that they've got, their needs, and what we as a state are asking foster parents to be able to do. She gave the example, when the fisticuffs start flying, what do you do? So it's talking about the level of some of the children in our system and some of the things that are happening. We are doing a better job in terms of trying to identify confirming safe environments, and that's a new key concept with our new model, is to make sure that we have all staff understand they all have a role in this. So every time they're seeing children, they need to be assessing this on an ongoing basis, and following up with how it is that we're serving families, both in family foster care and residential treatment as well. You'll note then that there's the comparison. So on page, I hope you have the same page numbers that I have, 106, you'll see where we're comparing ours to the rest of the state. The first one there says 0.32. That should read 0.57. And then the rest of that chart is correct. The fourth federal measure that the federal government looks upon at this point in time is stability of foster care placements. And we've already heard testimony before about how critical it is that these kids are stable in their placements, and that we've all heard the stories of kids moving from home to home to home to home. And the reality is, when we start looking at what is Oregon charting on in terms of how many placements is a child having in their first 12 months that they actually come into care, and that we are supposed to have no more than 2 placements in their first 12 months in care in order to meet the standard. And as you can see from the chart, we're just hovering right at the national standard, just a little bit below at this point in time, around placement stability. So in many ways, we're doing a good job. Could we do better? Absolutely. Do we need to do better? Absolutely. And certainly for those kids that are moving frequently, we've heard stories, and we know stories, and we know situations where they've moved frequently. That's those areas we need to really address. Why is this child moving? And get back into our policy that talks about placement matching and trying to figure out what is the best home for this child, and also trying to understand that when we place a child into a shelter type program, a receiving center, some facility out there, that counts as a move. So today, when a police officer might pick a child up, we might have a placement, the child might go to a shelter program. That's their first move. Tomorrow we might find a relative or another foster home for the child and then move there, which is the right thing for the child to do. That's 2 moves. So that's the limitations we have on placement moves and placement stability, but nevertheless, it's important that we continue to focus on the stability of these children in care, and in the new model we're talking about is reassess that on a regular basis. Is this the right placement for the child, and how do we support that child?
Excuse me, please. Representative, I apologize for interrupting you, but is there some way you could tag that so that it's clear that it's like all the things that when you say, you know, 3 times and it's bad, but the individual times may not, like in that case, it sounds like you're moving toward a better deal for the child, but it says 2 and it just looks bad because it's too many moves.
Chair Carter, Representative Boone, this is an ongoing conversation with the federal government in terms of how this measure is attached to success or not success. The most recent part of that conversation is a debate about a child who has a chronic physical illness and may need to go in and out of the hospital periodically, and they're wanting to count those as moves as well. And so we understand the frustration around this particular measure. We also know that placement stability is very critical for children, and so finding that fine line in between. But right now the federal government says any move that's more than 24 hours is a move. It is a new placement. And so that's one of the parameters we have as a definition.
Mm-hmm. Senator Morissette, Senator Bates,
thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you. Well, it seems to me that if you did footnote it, that would, and send it to the feds footnoted, that would at least inform them, and it would clarify your own record keeping locally. And I think you should footnote, asterisk or footnote, what the circumstances are, so we know. And then the feds would also know and maybe get an idea.
No, thank you. Gee, I wish things were simpler. When I read this, and I read it last night and last, yesterday and the end of the day, I'm just trying to get a feel for what really is going on in foster care, and these percentages just don't get me there. Maybe it's me. What I really like to know is, how long are most kids in foster care? Do they stay in one home most of that time? And it probably isn't that simple, because these kids have such varying needs, and physical and emotional needs. We also know for the physical and mental development of a child, having them in a safe, stable environment where they stay for a prolonged period of time is vitally important. You can imagine, and I'm sure you have imagined, moving a child every 6 months or 3 months or whatever, and potentially changing schools and changing their peer groups and moving them in and out of families is devastating those kids. I mean, you know, most of us think we have to move our kids to a different school district. That's a major achievement, you know. And these kids have lost their parents, lost their families, and are just potentially going through a system that can bounce them around. So if you could, is there any way you can kind of give us a picture of what the real picture is? And I understand the constraints the feds have put on you. I mean, you know.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, we can do that. It sounds like I wrote down three things. One, average length of placement. We can give you that. We can give you the median placement. What does it look like for most children in care? And then the number of placements for those particular children. It's kind of the use of a cohort piece of material. Because one of the things that happens is the child who is multiply placed may have significant and challenging issues, and that may result in that child being multiply placed. That's not necessarily a good thing, but the average career of the child in foster care is not the child who has the 14 and 15 moves. But we can come back to you with that kind of detail about the children that are in the system now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of gives me a more meaningful picture for me. Thank you.
One of the things that you might want to mention is that sometimes it's the children themselves who cause the move.
That's what I'm thinking.
And so sometimes that can help. One thing we can do in foster care, we can't do in biological families, and that is if kids don't like the family, they can't go anywhere, but in foster care, you can move them.
Ms. Cotet. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that would be really helpful information that Dr. Bates was asking for. I think breaking it out by age cohort, too, because the older children, the youth, tend to stay longer, might have more moves, because as you recall, this measure is only for a 12-month period. So if you're in for 2 years and have three or more, and the more moves, the more instability. The one thing I just wanted to mention is all of you should have received Children First for Oregon's data book, and they now report these types of measures by county for those who want to see them, the placement stability, the reabuse rates, because some of it is pretty, there are some local differentiations past the state average, so if people want to look at that, it's in that book.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to know, I've been sitting here now for a week and trying to digest everything, and it's what I hear is mostly really good that I support. But one of the bills that you have listed on the supplement paper today, 2182, that disparity between paying non-relatives but not paying relatives just really got under my skin the other day when we were talking about it. And then when I see the bill here that you'd be applying a means test, I have to tell you I will oppose the bill because of that means test. Is there any way we could get around that?
Chair Carter and Representative Garrard, as a legislator, that is what you can do. It is our policy package, but, you know, in the conversation with Representative Kotek the other day, she was asking questions about how did we arrive at that. It's a conservative way of approaching the issue. There is another bill right now, and I don't have the number of that bill.
Senate Bill 282.
282. That would require paying all relatives, irregardless of the income limit. So that is certainly something, I think, on this policy package that you all would want to debate and think about.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Ben.
Chair Carter, I would move us then into talking about some of the quality efficiencies within the out-of-home care program. And again, I always want to keep it in context of what is our primary goal. Our primary goal in out-of-home care certainly is keeping the children safe, but it's also working towards getting them back home. So it's important to look at how many children come into the system and how many children actually are leaving and leaving successfully to back with relatives. Within families. It's also important then to identify when we're looking at how many kids we're actually serving and who it is we are providing that care for. Again, we've talked about relatives a number of times here the last 2 days. On page 108, I provide you the information there in terms of what is the percentage of children placed with their relatives. And as you can see, over the last 5 years, we've been ticking away at trying to up that number. And as it's already been raised, we need to continue to do that, go in that direction. One of the things that's very interesting in Oregon that we do a good job in is trying to identify those families, relative or those that know the child, and certify them to care for that child. And we actually call them specially certified families versus a regular certified family. And the difference being a regular certified foster family is someone that comes in to care for any child that may be presented to them, whereas a special certified family is either the relative or it's the coach, it's somebody that knows this child, and we certify them just for that child and that child alone. And when we look at the overall 5,300 families that I've said before that we certify, more than half of them are specially certified for specific children. So that's part of what drives that workload amongst the staff, is to say, if we're going to have to certify this family for this one child, we're doing the same thing we do for a foster home that serves 5 or 6 children. So we have more specially certified homes, which is good for children, than we do regular homes at this point in time. So it's something that the pendulum just switched here recently.
Madam Chair, Senator,
thank you. Can you disaggregate the data for us by race and ethnicity so that we have a clearer picture of who these families are?
Chair Carter, Representative Gorley, we certainly could do that. We've had some limitations within the data system when we were looking at race ethnicity of the foster families. So if that's the question, who are the foster families caring for these children versus who are these children and which families are being cared for, can we clarify for
my
me?
My question goes to what you're presenting to us are averages, average number of families certified.
Correct.
As foster families. And I'd be interested in knowing what the actuals look like and disaggregating that information by race and ethnicity.
Great.
This question is in terms of whether you want it in terms of the family, who are the caretakers or providers, or you want it to children?
Families. Certified. The families certified as foster families to care for children.
Chair Carter, Senator Gorley, we have that information, and I hedge my answer just on that anything within the database we've got for our foster home providers is limiting at best. And at times it may be that we have mixed race families, and so we actually might have a larger number that won't be as specific to what you look at, but we can certainly pull what we've got available at this point in time and separate the 5,300 families currently.
I think it's important that we, where we do not disaggregate data, that we start doing that. Again, what we want to have is a clear picture of whom we're serving, where, and what the outreach looks like, and we won't know unless you give us the data that tells us what that picture looks like.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordon, that is actually part of, I mentioned yesterday, something called SACWIS, which is the statewide automated child welfare information system. That kind of detail is required in that data system that we are moving to. And it's going to be about another 2 years to we're there. But it will have the entire inventory of all foster families, and it's going to be very helpful to staff, if you can imagine, because they need to have that kind of information to be able to find most appropriate placements for children. Mm-hmm. It'll have information such as, this is a foster family who can care for the following kinds of special needs of a child. And all of it will be in that database. Some states are there now. Other states like us are still trying to get to that place, but that is part of the design of that system.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thanks. First, I want to tell you that whenever they're in the paper, those little ads that you have with a picture of kids, I think they're the best ads I've ever seen. I don't know who writes them, but their caseworker really shows somebody who got to know that child or children, and I just really appreciate you doing that. Second is, I had a question on, and maybe you don't even know, but is it harder to find foster parents for older children? And if so, is there any way, because they're getting so close in that it's 13 and above, I'm guessing 13 to 18 or maybe even 21 soon, but is there an advantage to marketing the need to your potential families with the urgency that these older children, while they've probably been through more that way at that point, they need a different kind of approach because they're going to be going out on their own soon, plus they're spending more time, you know, in school and out among other people. And the point is to get them, get their self-esteem back and help them become a citizen that's going to be working in our community, and hopefully, like the young women yesterday, becoming a mentor to other foster children. So obviously we want them to be having a successful transition. I know it's a long statement, but I'm curious about that because I think that's a really vulnerable population.
Chair Carter, Representative Boone, absolutely. In fact, there's different strategies on recruiting families for older teens, and that is one of our most difficult groups to find enough placements for is the teenagers, for a lot of reasons. But there is different strategies, and some of those strategies around recruitment really are not necessarily the ads in the paper, the billboards, the TV spots. Those attract folks for younger children. The older children, quite honestly, one of the best strategies is ask the youth. Who do you know? Do you have friends? Who else might be able to take you in? And is there something we can look for, especially certified families? So really accessing those, accessing the high schools and the communities that are involved, it's going out to those high schools and really trying to be a part of that community to find out who are the families. You know, we have school counselors, we have school principals. Who are the families in your high school that could do this, or at least have enough connections to tell us who to find out? So it's different strategies on how we actually find those, but they're a challenge. They absolutely are.
Chair Carter and Representative Boone, I can recall as a young caseworker being told that ideally you should have 4 homes to select whenever you've got a child who needs placement, because the idea is to be able to match the child's needs with what the family can offer. And if you look at our figures, if we've got 5,309 families, but we have 7,734 children in foster care on any day, we are greatly limited in the ability to match, and that leads to other kinds of outcomes. We know from research, not in this state, but research nationally, that the reason for abuse and neglect in foster care is because of a bad match between what that foster parent expected in terms of who the child was coming into the home and what the needs of the child are. So you're absolutely right, and it's something I think we have to do a much better job of in terms of getting families willing to care for teenagers. A lot of families will come forward for little children, but when it's teens, it does take an entirely different strategy for people to invest, because those years are so critical for those young people.
Just a quickie. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, we talked about possibly a mentoring program or Big Sister, Big Brother, and maybe that could lead to a placement with that particular person, because I think you'd really want to help that child, and I don't remember her name, Nicole, thank you. Nicole pointed out that even at 18, she felt she wasn't really ready to go out, and a lot of kids aren't at that age, because there's got to be some suppression of advancement as far as development and all kinds of areas when you have all these other issues going on that have caused you to become involved in the system. And I'm just wondering if some, like a lunch buddy program that they have for younger kids in schools, do the schools have anything like that now that they could see in the high school? Do they have people come in and help, or could they have people come in and help bond if you will, for lack, I'm not thinking really straight right now, but bonding with a kid who is in foster care or needs foster care or you know may need is getting crucial, and working with the counselors or whatever, and maybe that is a smoother transition than bouncing them around, because they're probably already going to feel nobody wants them at that point.
Chair Carter, Representative Boone, absolutely. There are a variety of things that folks try. It's everything from caseworkers knowing their community. The schools do have programs. In fact, one of the, I think, more, one of the great programs that we're actually involved in is called Aspire, and it's with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And what we try to do is we do some work with our independent living youth, tying up to the Aspire program, so they're actually being mentored in high school about looking at college, looking at other things to be advancing to.
Okay.
We do a lot of stuff with our system of care, and you'll hear about those budgets and different things. And one of the things with system of care is sometimes using mentorships. How do you find those? And there's a great program in Portland that really reaches out to a lot of our kids, either in the system or previously in the system, and mentors kids along for a very number of years. The program's slipping my mind right now, but it's a great program in the Portland area for mentorship. So that is very key to that.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Carter, I would then go on to say, just at the end of page 108, is that one of the other efficiencies we believe through some work we're going to be doing is a budget savings of $3 million in special rates. Part of what we're really looking at is in reviewing the application of that program. Again, that's where we're looking at special needs children in foster care and trying to identify some specific things that we could do to manage that budget better by increasing some of the management support at the local level and a variety of other strategies.
Let me ask one question on number three, on page 108. How are you going to manage the program that you have right now, especially when you've already found $3 million in savings and you're trying to balance and monitor things to bring about more efficiencies?
Sure. Senator Chair Carter, part of what we're looking at is really trying to take a very honest look at actually how we operate that program now and where it is that we can put in some management oversight to develop some consistency. Because part of what we look for is to say a young person that's living out in Burns, that's living in Salem, might have very similar needs, might have very similar behaviors, similar ages, similar issues all along, yet the rates we actually are paying to foster parents might be different. And why is that difference? And part of it is on local structures and what we're providing to a family or what we're not providing to a family. So part of it is to be honestly looking at our program and how as we're managing that, and are there some more efficiencies? The other thing is to be very clear about trying to identify what is the needs of our children. If our children's needs are mental health, we need to make sure we're receiving those mental health services. If some of the needs for our children are medically related, which we've got a number of kids that have medically needed services, and we're challenged with that at this point in time to be able to say these children are in family foster care, and without the medical homes that we have, some of these children still be in the hospital, and we've been using different funding streams for that. So part of it is making sure we're looking at resources that are out there, accessing them as much as we possibly can, and then managing what we actually have as far as a budget.
So you have not cut, you have not transferred kids out of one specialty area into a lower specialty area as to why you found those savings?
Okay. No, Chair Carter.
And Chair Carter, these are projected savings. This is about going forward into the new biennium and making sure, I think the two things that are really key, we're going to use the same criteria across the whole state. Counties won't have to create their own criteria for who qualifies, what child needs to have a special rate. And then we'll have a process that is totally objective in terms of how the decisions are made around those special rate cases. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to give us a much better idea, even early into the new biennium, as to what the issue really is around special rates.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. That maybe answers my question. The discrepancy in race depended on the county support then? Between Burns and Portland, say, that example.
Chair Carter and Senator Morissette, it's not so much because the counties don't participate financially in that rate, but what it is how decisions are made, and you can't, when you look at a list of all 36 counties, there's not a real clear correlation to how that criteria or that decision gets made from county to county.
May I?
You may.
Is that a county problem or is that a state problem?
Chair Carter and Senator Marr said we take responsibility since it's a statewide program, and we're already working with the counties on this. We had gotten the special rates, had gotten to the point that they were over 50% of our children in foster care.
Okay.
That makes it not very special. Now it's below 50%, but we want to make sure that no child is harmed by us taking management actions, and so we're going to be very diligent about how we do this. And the idea is not to reduce the special rate that's paid for a child, no across-the-board special rate reductions, but also making sure we're applying the same criteria in all 36 counties and how we're doing it, that there's management action that's consistent across the state.
Representative Fletcher. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it true that this is a $3 million reduction in general fund, but I assume there's matching for this? So what's the total reduction or total savings?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, if you look on page 111, at the bottom of that actually talks about the reductions in this one specifically, and it identifies the other funds, the federal funds. So it's a $7.8 million total fund package.
Thank you. Follow-up? Is the plan to reinvest the $7.8 million somehow? You can't reinvest the match, but you could reinvest the $3 million in general fund that you're, quote-unquote, saving. Is that the plan? Was that redirected internally to child welfare?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, that is, I would say, without being the budget person who handles the technical language around this, that is the intent. We are trying to invest in things in the child welfare system that we think actually will curtail the need for children to get so deep into the system that they have extraordinary special needs. An example of that is the alcohol and drug abuse treatment. Helping families keep children in home without them having to come into foster care. Foster care in and of itself can contribute to a child becoming a special needs child. As we talked about earlier, the multiple placements, the lack of consistency, the lack of stability. And so it is around trying to take some of these dollars that are in the deep end of the system and move those towards the front end of the system to better serve families and children. Follow up?
Yes, thank you. And I appreciate that, and that makes me feel a little bit better. I'll tell you, I have concerns about this reduction. We've heard for several years that we're seeing more high-need children coming into the foster care system because of being removed from meth homes and things like that. I don't know if we can control that. If we've got half the kids who need special needs, we have half the kids who need special needs. I do agree there needs to be consistency across the state in how we apply. What are most people would agree are already low rates. The special rate is a bump up, but it's still inadequate in general. So, if you could guarantee that we're going to reinvest that at the front end or somewhere in the system, I mean, at least it would lessen my concern at this time.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I appreciate that. And I think as our policy packages roll forward, you will see that amount of money is reinvested. There's more money than that we're actually asking to put in the front of the system. I think in terms of the individual children, again, we're not going to make decisions that are going to harm individual situations. One of the things the state does, and states around the country are really struggling with this because it's a decision about do you just up the entire foster care board payment? If it's low, do you just make that higher and then not deal with special rates? But one of the things we want to explore is instead of increasing the amount of the payment, what if we increase the service? What if we put the service into that family and then take the service out when it's no longer needed? What happens with special rates is families start building that as part of their care of the child. And then it's very difficult to say to a foster family, you have done so extraordinarily well with this child that we're going to cut your payment now. You won't be getting as much as a board payment as you were getting. And that makes it's also a disincentive if the child is eligible for adoption. Yeah. All of a sudden, that payment doesn't go forward into adoption. And a little bit later today, you'll hear that's one of the issues we have to struggle with is, do I just keep the child in foster care then because they qualify for special rate, or do I allow the child or try to encourage the foster parent to adjust to using the adoption assistance payment? So it is a very complex issue, and I appreciate your thoughts on it. We do have an active committee that's just starting, and if people would like more information or to be involved in some of that discussion, we would welcome that.
I would like to know who's on that committee. That would be helpful.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get through decision packages so that at 2 o'clock we can go to adoptions. Is 30 minutes a long enough time?
If Chair Carter, we'll make that work.
Okay, but if she doesn't finish, then we'll have to figure something out.
The packages are actually in this part of it. And so when we get to adoption, there are not additional policy option packages. So that'll make that one faster.
And Chair Carter, I would just ask the committee at some point in time to note page 109 to go back and read, just because there's some good successes there the department's had. And I just don't want to overlook. Actually, I don't want to go back to the office and tell staff that I didn't raise the issue of how good they worked.
Right. Staff, we don't want you to think that.
There we go. So I'm going to talk about policy packages starting on page 112. The first policy package is Representative Garrard and Representative Kotek have already talked about. So relative care reimbursement. Again, this is to try to, an effort to try to pay those relatives that are caring for children that we are not otherwise paying right now. Again, the payments that we've talked about earlier is that this ranges everywhere from $387 a month to $497 based on the child's age. So we're really talking about a $14 a day. What we have identified in our budget package is a delayed implementation date to July 1st of 2008. So a one-year delay, as well as issuing a means test, and those are the two primary issues that folks are struggling with at this point in time.
Ms. Speaker. Madam Chair, if I could ask a question. Is there any reason, if the funding were available, that you couldn't implement this July 2007? Is there a mechanical reason for the delay?
Chair Carter, Ms. Baker. Got your last name, I'm sorry. Ms. Baker, no, there is not. We could implement it July 1st this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because there was just a brief amount of discussion about this a few minutes ago, I wanted to let you know that some of what I would like a little bit of information about to help assist us with our subsequent discussion on the committee is we're not a policy committee. We're a ways and means. We're supposed to look at the budget and how the money is being used, and is it being used effectively, just as you both are explaining to us, where you're trying to put some extra money, which means you might need to take some away from here, put it someplace else where the investment will go farther. On this particular one, to help us understand both the policy impact and the fiscal impact of what's described as House Bill 2182, will you please tell us for the future what performance measure is affected by this change? What we'll see the improvement in numbers or percentages? And for example, if this was not passed, so this is a way of, as you put it, being able to serve more families or more children and more families. If this were not passed, does it mean you would serve fewer families, or does it just mean that money that might have been freed up, for example, increasing the number of caseworkers or improving other reimbursement rates, would it affect how much money was available for those other goals that we've discussed?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, we can absolutely provide a more thorough answer. What I'll give you just a real high-level quick response to that is there are a number of things that are barriers to relatives caring for children that are coming into them, and one of those barriers is financial reasons. And so at times, I'm not going to be able to go back to the office and come back and tell you there's 100 families that couldn't take in their niece because of financial reasons. But what I can tell you, certainly from personal experience of working with families, and certainly from other staff at this point in time, is at times finances is the barrier, and that if we're able to provide payment to that family, they may be able to actually take in their niece or nephew or grandchild. We certainly have characteristics, and one of the questions that was raised from somebody the other day was, can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what these families look like? Age, demographics, income, and we can provide that. National research usually tells you that oftentimes relatives taking children in are single parents using low income. A variety of other characteristics. So it is a challenge to do that. So it's a barrier that we're trying to solve. It's not the only barrier. There's other barriers around communication. There's other barriers around providing training. There's other barriers around trying to have grandmother, if she's now 60 years old and all of a sudden she's got a two-year-old, her whole social network has changed. So there's a lot of those practice issues. This is one piece of a pie that we believe that performance measure you'd look for is the next time I come back, Ms. Foley allows me to, is that we'd be looking at higher numbers of kids with relatives. We look at placement stability better with relatives, because we know placement stability from research says kids with relatives are more stable in placement. They're not moving from stranger home to stranger home. So those would be the indicators I would look for. The other piece that's important to know, though, is in Oregon, we're talking about 500 kids here now. With our means test, we would take about 400. There's about another 100 that would not be served under this. So you're not going to see huge spikes, you know, with 400 children in a 16,000 system. But that is the goal, to keep looking at placement stability, more children with relatives, and reduce the relative barriers.
Thank you.
I will move on to the next policy option package, and this one is a coming forward as a result of some federal legislation changes, and it's called the Safe and Timely Interstate Placement for Children, for Foster Children. And that's partly what we chatted about yesterday a little bit, is interstate compact for placement of children. When children are moved to another state, we have children go to other states. Other states have children come to us, and the federal government is stepping in to say we need to expedite these placements. We need to get those home studies back in a timely manner. So they're putting in restrictions to say states will have 60 days to get those home studies back. So if somebody's, so if Tennessee is sending a child to Oregon, we're going to have 60 days to get those home studies back to them so that they can make final decisions for their children. And that certainly ups the ante on us being able to work faster on all of our studies, as well as, hopefully, the flip side will happen when we send kids out to other states, we'll get a better response from other states and request that done in a more timely fashion. We're looking at this budget package requesting 7 additional caseworkers and 1 support staff person. That would be able to work towards increasing our ability to get those children to decisions quicker and compliance with the federal regulations. The next policy option package is called the Behavioral Rehabilitation Services. It's a rate increase. Part of what we've been faced with there is that within the budget cuts over the last several years, we have not been able to keep up with the market rate for the services of behavioral rehabilitation services for our children. So as we try to place children in programs, we have been unable to keep up with the market. And part of what we have is we have Oregon Youth Authority, who also uses the same programs as our children. And so this budget package would actually try to bring us up to rate parity with that program as it stands now. I have been aware, and folks will probably testify tomorrow, that we'll talk about, but then OA might take the next step up, again, creating that gap. So be aware that what we're talking about here is we're trying to raise our level of payments to providers who have not had cost of living increases and other things so that they can keep their program stable, and that's what we're trying to do, is bring in some parity at this point in time.
Ms. Baker? Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just want to sort of underscore what Mr. George just said. In the governor's budget, in fact, OYA has some additional funding that gets them back to an uneven playing field, if you will. This package does bring Department of Human Services up to where the Oregon Youth Authority's essential budget level would be, but then there's an additional $6 million in the OYA budget to increase their rates another 20 to 25% above this. So as we move forward on this budget and on the OYA budget, that's an issue that will need some work.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Baker, for that, because we're playing catch-up. If OYA goes up, this might not be enough. Could you comment just briefly on why this rate increase is important? Because I'm assuming this has put a burden on the contractors when they haven't had this increase over the years. Are we seeing any deterioration in our service availability? I assume we are.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, absolutely. And part of what you look at is losing beds and contracts. You know, folks, programs are a struggle. Certainly all the services we've seen over the last several, 8 years or so of budget cuts and budget reductions, certainly in rural communities, are struggling. And it's hard to retain staff and retain staff long enough so they develop the knowledge, skills, and abilities to care for some of these highly specialized kids. So part of it is stability for these programs in order for them to be able to hire staff and retain them. And so if they can't do that, they then choose not to contract with DHS, and they choose a contract with private agent, some other program out there.
Thank you.
The last policy option package that I'll spend a moment talking about is the staffing for our children's benefit unit. And what we're looking for in this point here is adding 2 staff. And this is in our central office where 10 years ago we had 8 staff that did these functions, and now we're down to 2. This brings us back up to 4. And what their job is to actually identify the children that are in foster care, seek supplemental security income, so SSI eligibility. So many of our kids are eligible, but if we don't have the staff available to actually apply for that, track that, get those funds in, then we are not receiving those that revenue into the state funds. And so part of this is that these staff actually will be the ones that will be seeking that out in a much more assertive manner than we've been able to do the last 7 or 8 years of trying to get Social Security income for the children, as well as them being a conduit and a resource to local field staff who at times then will say, I've got this child aging out of the system, they're SSI eligible, how do I switch the payee to the payer status? And that's some of the support they provide. So at one point in time when the children leave our system, either because they've been reunified with the family or they now are an adult, then the payee status from the federal government switches from the state of Oregon to that person. So these folks help understand, help facilitate those kind of practices. So we believe adding 2 more staff will be able to assist our ability to gather more revenue in for SSI benefits specifically for children in foster care. There's no other things, Senator Carter. I'm looking at my clock, and it's just approaching 2 o'clock. I think that was what you requested.
Yes, Speaker. Madam Chair, I'd like to throw something out on the table here. This isn't in the governor's budget, and I just wanted to call the subcommittee's attention to it. It's an issue about what's not funded in terms of inflation and caseload increases in some of the child substitute care programs and child safety programs, specifically foster care prevention, independent living, other medical and nursing assessment services. Because these are funded in part with capped federal funds, as the budget is built, and there's inflation or caseload increases in those programs, because they're considered non-mandated programs for budget building purposes, they didn't get funded in the essential budget level. The governor's budget didn't fund the policy package that would fund those. And so relative to where the agency projected their expenditures to be, the governor's budget has a $2.7 million general fund hole in it. Now, that's an issue, again, as we're working forward in this budget, that we think you should keep in mind and look at those particular programs and see if they are important programs for you to fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Wardley, and then Senator Representative. Ms. Baker, the third item was the other medical.
It's called other medical. I believe it's mostly used like testing for parents, perhaps urinalysis testing to see if kids can indeed come home after they've been in foster care, things that aren't covered by Medicaid or other particular insurance sources.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about the last package you described, staffing for Children's Benefits Unit. It looks like a total funds $200,000 cost. Am I reading that correctly? But you also mentioned that this would bring money into the state or to the children, money that isn't currently coming in. What is the projected income so that you could look at this as rather than a net figure? This is only the first amount. What's the gain, the net gain?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathan said, in other words, as that money comes in, it's used to offset the cost of the care of the child. And I think your question is, has that been factored into this particular piece? And I'm looking to John Swartzen or Alisa Tran.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the records, my name is Alisa Tran. I'm the Budget Administrator for Children, Adults, and Family. In reviewing this package, we discovered that the additional revenue generated was left out. For each of the staff person added in this package, we expect that person to bring in an estimated $4,673 in additional revenue per month.
So over a biennium, that
Follow-up, please.
So over a biennium, can you tell us how much that would be?
Yeah, so over the biennium, this was calculated for 21 months. So these numbers are rough, but we expect to be around 800,000. So actually, in this particular case, we would not be requesting for general fund. We would be requesting, because we will get the funding from the revenue stream, we will simply be asking for an increase in other fund limitation.
Please.
So then the follow-up is there's a net gain, and that would be more resources available for this program. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that is correct.
Thank you.
Can you repeat the one from follow-up?
Please do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess I want to make sure. So the quicker you can get a child on SSI and they get a benefit, that will come out of the amount that you pay the family? Is that how you generate the savings?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, yes, the SSI is used for the child's room and board, which is the intent of that, and so that's used then to offset what the state will be paying towards the foster care payment.
Great, thank you.
And
I'm happy to see this here in the child welfare section, but I know we also talked about in the TANF package as well. Will there be coordination between this unit and the TANF folks who are also trying to do this very same thing for the TANF families?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I sure hope so.
Okay, good.
Third debate.
Thank you. Is there a general fund savings in this? If you move people faster at SSI, is there general fund savings in this, or is just a break even from a general fund point of view?
Yeah. Chair Carter and Senator Bates, there would be general fund savings if, in fact, general fund is being used to match the federal fund to keep the child in foster care now. Wouldn't that be correct, Lisa?
Yes, that is correct.
Has that been calculated?
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, I think that's what we're talking about right now. The calculation here doesn't reflect what these two staff people would generate in terms of the return.
Well, the breakout is 40% GF, 60% FF. That's a rate for the program. What I indicated was that the two staff person, each one of them would bring in about $4,673 per month, and that is based on on a couple things. We expect to have 10 applications per month per worker, and out of those we expect a 75% success rate. That is, when they apply for SSI, 75% of those would be successful, and at an average benefit of $620 per month that the child would get in.
I don't care if I can maybe just try to bottom line this. So I think what the agency is saying is that the package, as it's in the governor's budget, didn't have the revenue built in. They will revise that package, and when we get to reshoot before work session, we'll see revised numbers that don't have a general fund cost and may have a general fund offset in other places.
And Representative Mason, what happens is that when the department has used more dollars than they've been expected to use, they come back in and through the emergency board and ask the emergency board for those funds so they can continue with the program direction in which they are at this particular point. And that's why we call it reshoot at that particular point. Thank you.
Chair Carter, and that's the end of the members of the committee. That's the end of the presentation on at-home care. Appreciate the time everybody's taken to learn. Very, very wise group, and I appreciate that information. There'll be more you'll be getting in writing from us.
Thank you.
Okay. And as he departs, Angela Cause will join me. And Angela is our adoption manager. She came to us in September of this past year, and this is her first time testifying here in Oregon.
It will be nice.
And we were able to snag her from Arizona. She was the adoptions manager in Arizona, but she actually went to school as an undergraduate in Portland and then got her master's in social work at the Arizona State. She's told me, though, she's originally from Mississippi, so she's a Southern girl. And she currently serves also on the executive committee for the National Association of State Adoption Programs. So I am pleased and delighted to have her here as our adoption manager.
Ms. Cause, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Carter. Chair Carter and committee members, for the record, my name is Angela Cause, and I am the adoption program manager for the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. I am pleased at this point of the afternoon to speak with you about our adoption program. For the last couple of days, we have talked about the importance and value of maintaining children in their original homes, the families of origin. We've spoken about the importance of returning those children to those homes as soon as possible, and we're pleased that we have the 64% average of being able to do that. Unfortunately, on the occasion when it is determined that it is not in the best interest of a child to return to their family of origin, to the biological family,
It is our responsibility in the adoption program to establish permanency for those children through some other means. Adoption and guardianship are established as the two most reasonable and legally sound options for permanency when return to parent does not work. The Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1997 enforced some very strict time frames of moving children to permanency by way of adoption, and with that drastically increased the number of adoptions occurring across the country for children in foster care. Oregon is no different than other states in that it here has seen a drastic increase in the number of adoptions for children exiting foster care. Over the last 10 to 11 years in Oregon, we in fact have tripled the number of children leaving foster care by way of adoption. As such, if you look on your page 114, you'll see the pie chart there that shows adoption assistance as the aspect of our program that carries the bulk of our funding. These funds go directly to the children who are adopted from foster care with the intent of allowing a family to be able to continue to meet the special needs of those children. You'll also see by that pie chart that we have additional support services there in the way of post-adopt services for families. That provides for families things such as support groups, trainings, resources, connection to community resources, those types of things to add in some additional supports to their ability to be able to meet the needs of their children. Adoption subsidy or adoption assistance is in place to provide a supplemental support to families. The role of the department changes quite a bit when adoption occurs. As we mentioned, I believe, yesterday, that we as the state, for all intents and purposes, serves as the parent for a child when care, custody, and control is given to us by the court. When we exit a child from foster care to adoption, that responsibility passes on to the adoptive parent. The role of the department then is to serve in a supplemental capacity to that family to assist them in their ability to meet the special needs of their children. Adoption subsidy provides, as such, financial support, again, to meet the special needs of the children, a medical card to ensure that they do have medical services for themselves. And as I mentioned, the post-adoption services are in addition to that so that they're able to access community resources, that there are support groups out there for them. We find that for adoptive families, the best support that they can have is that they get from other adoptive families. When we look at the remainder of the pie chart, we also have services there that help us in reaching the determination of when it is best for a child to move to adoption or to move to guardianship. We have resources there to assist us in being able to have families available to service the children who are needing an adoptive placement in the way of recruitment, training, supervision, and support to those families. We also have resources unique to Oregon, and that is the adoption assistance search aspect of our program, where we provide a registry that allows for folks to come back after an adoption and, in fact, through our means, facilitate a search of their own to reconnect with biological family if, in fact, they've lost that connection. Then finally, the piece of the pie chart there is independent adoptions. In Oregon, we have the responsibility for some oversight and regulation to all adoptions that occur, even those that occur outside of our state, outside of the department's responsibility. So that takes in the adoptions that occur from our independent agencies. A question, Ms. Carter?
Thank you. Didn't mean to interrupt. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wanting to know, because the final pie chart on the last page shows the other fund, total fund breakout. Of the adoption assistance, which is the bulk of the budget, how much of that is general fund and how much is federal fund or other funds?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotak, the amount that comes from our federal government in support is 65%. The amount from general fund is 35%.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I've referenced the services that are provided by the program, including the recruitment of families, the facilitation of freeing children for adoption, and the determination of what is an appropriate case for the children. Our services are provided across the state in all 36 states, 36 counties, pardon me, broken down to 16 districts. Again, the services are for those children who are in care when it is determined it is not in the best interest for them to return to the care of their biological family. In fiscal year, federal fiscal year 05, we in Oregon facilitated and finalized 1,033 adoptions, which is 9.9% increase over the 2004 year.
Can you give us a breakdown of ages? Because about 10 years ago, I remember we were in really trouble, and we facilitated more money to adoption because the higher-end kids, the older kids, were not being adopted. Of these 1,000 and some odd kids, is that a breakdown age group?
Yeah. Oh, Ms. Baker has it. Thank you.
Perhaps the agency would respond as well, but in the book that was handed out earlier, the Status of Children book, the back part of that book, it relates to adoptions. And on page 38, it shows the age of the adopted children and the ethnic breakdown of that, and then other information by county as well.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Chair Carter, as Ms. Baker has indicated, on page 8, it does provide for you some demographics regarding our children who are adopted. And specific to address your question regarding age, for the 2005 years reflected in the book, approximately 20% of the children who were adopted, actually almost 30%, it was 20.8% of the children who were adopted were over the age of 9. The remainder, 79% of children, were 0 to age 8.
So is it still true that the highest numbers of kids that are harder to place are African-American kids?
Chair Carter, I would say that the challenges in placing children for adoption not only involve race, African-American children certainly being a part of that as children of color, but it also includes age, children over the age of 9 and 7 groups.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I said it was going to be nice when we go through you off guard, and I did just that, didn't I? My apologies.
Chair Carter, that's quite fine. I have Ms. Foley to keep me on guard here.
Okay. She's pretty good at that.
She's great at keeping us on task, and I appreciate it. I'd like to move on, please, to outcome measures, if we may, so that we can utilize the remainder of our time, and speak with you about two performance measures that impact our work with adoptions here in Oregon. The first is both are regarding timeliness to adoption. The first performance is measure is to evaluate Oregon's timeliness to achieving permanency from foster care into adoption. And in this first measure, we're looking at whether or not a state for all the children who exited foster care during the period that was reviewed for finalized adoptions, that 32% or more of those children exited care in less than 24 months. 32% of children exiting foster care to adoption in less than 24 months. And when we look at our state, we see that while we have steadily improved over the years, we have not yet met that standard of 32%. We have improved from 2003 at 13.9, almost 14%, to currently in fiscal year 06 to 21.8%. If you will allow, as Mr. George
and Ms. Swanson did for us to look at a comparison on this time measure with adoption, this performance measure for adoption, to see how we compare with the other states in our region. If we look at Alaska, Idaho, and Washington, who are part of our region, and then also Oklahoma, who has a similar structure to ours, we'll see that based on the figures that were available to us in 03, again, our improvements are comparable to theirs. We're steadily improving. We are at the 21 point, almost 22% now, and Idaho in 03 was at 21.5%, Alaska a little bit ahead at 23.8%.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, the footnote I wrote in my notes about this is keep in mind on your two policy packages, two things. One, we are comparing ourselves nationally with states that have complete legal representation. So for the moment the case is open, somebody is looking at the legal grounds, looking at legal sufficiency, whether or not there's going to be a need to consider termination of parental rights. And one of the problems we have is by the time we get on down the road with the case and determine that, yes, this is probably going to be an adoption case, then we've got an attorney stepping in and trying to go back to day one and figure out where's the evidence, how did we serve the family, does it meet the legal standard? So that's always a caveat that I think it's important to keep in mind. The second is, in your policy option package that we'll talk about next Wednesday, we have not had a formula where we actually earn adoption staff. And that is part of that policy package. We were given adoption staff sometime prior to 1999, I don't know when, but about 67 staff. And as we have tripled the number of adoptions, what we've done is we've tried to rely on other staff, foster care staff primarily, to try to move that workload forward. So both of those things really impact how successful we can be in the measures that Angela's describing.
But under the circumstances, I'm going to give you kudos, because if you don't have somebody that really has the responsibility of adoption and don't have the legal representation, we hamper your ability to be to practice excellence, quite frankly.
Well, and Chair Carter, that, to Senator Marcet's point, that always requires a footnote, I think, the fact that we do have that uniqueness about how our measures are.
Question, Dr. Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Knowing what we all know about child development, the first 3 or 4 years of life, when we look at these statistics, and I appreciate the incredible job you're trying to do with what few resources you have, I'm still very concerned about these children. A year, 2 years in a child's life is huge for a child, and just huge for how they're developing, what's going on with them. I would hope that some of these situations are you've placed a child very early with a family that's probably going to adopt them, so even though it's 2 or 3 years till they get that final thing done, they're actually with the family that's going to raise them and be with them and be their stable background. What I'm worried about is those kids that are going through a foster setting and then being moved into where they might be going. There's two issues here. One is, I think there is a reluctance for the state to allow foster families sometimes to adopt children, even though they've been with them for some time. And there's also a difficulty in those kids moving to foster home and at age 2, 3, or 4, or 5, going on to a new family and being adopted. Those are both concerns for me. But I'm hoping what we're really seeing here is not just measuring how long it takes to get the adoption. I'd rather know that they're a good family, being watched, and we're going through the paperwork, going through the legal stuff we have to get done, getting all that stuff done that we do with good, careful thought doing it. But what do you think is actually happening out there? Are most of these kids being placed in a family that's ultimately going to adopt them, or are a lot of them being moved around waiting for that adoption to be finalized?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, on page 40 of that same document, Status of the Child, which again we'll be updating within the next 6 weeks, it points out there that 72.6% of the children adopted from DHS or adopted by relatives or non-relative foster parents. That's probably a pretty good statistic in terms of some stability. It's where the child is living, and that evolves into being the adoptive placement. That doesn't happen, unfortunately, for all children. There are children who are freed for adoption and who wait for that placement to happen, and that's always a concern to us, because it was never the intention of the Adoption Safe Families Act to create legal orphans, and that's what can happen if you free children and you don't have adoptive placements for them.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Ms. Cause?
Thank you. Chair Carter, I'd like to move on, please, to the second outcome measure, that performance measure, and that is the median months to adoption. This measure allows for us in Oregon, through our program improvement plan, to look at the number of months it takes us to, in fact, achieve permanency for a child by way of adoption. And it says that for our state that we would to meet this indicator, if it is achieved a medium length of time from the date of the latest removal from home to finalize adoption of 36 months or less in two reporting periods. And we have been able to meet this performance measure. We have in 2003 and forward to 2006, each year decreased the number of months. We've seen a decline in the number of months it's taking us to move a child to finalization for adoption. In 2003, it being almost 24 months, and in 2006, down to a little less than 22 months to achieve adoption. Moving on to quality and efficiency improvements. Two areas that we wanted to look at that we know are directly impacting delays that occur are timelines to adoption. The first being the delays that are caused by an appeal from the biological parent to determination of their parental rights. And we have just recently, in October of 2006, moving to a pilot program with the Department of Justice, looking at using mediation as an option to hopefully deter this delay. We have found that in some instances the adoption can be delayed up to a year while we are waiting for the appeals process to work through itself. And the pilot project is too soon yet for us to provide any information in the way of outcomes, but we're hopeful that using the mediation process with the Department of Justice will allow for parents to come to some conclusion or some resolution regarding the termination of their parental rights and not create the further delays for the child moving on to permanency. The second area of improvement that we're looking at where we're concerned with delays has to do with the current use of our adoptive family selection process. In Oregon, we have used a committee process to select the most appropriate family to adopt a child based upon that child's needs. And for many years, this committee process has worked very efficiently and very well in serving our children. However, over the last year, we have seen or have had quite a bit of criticism come forward from various community stakeholders, primarily concerned that it is a closed process. And as such, we have seen and witnessed over this last year delays occurring where we are having challenges to decisions made by the committee and therefore not being able to move ahead with finalization for the child.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carter.
Thank you. Could you explain a little bit more about the committee and that process, and that there isn't a definition right in front of me of where is it, just one committee statewide, are they local committees, etc.?
Chair Carter, Representative Garrard, I'd like to provide a brief explanation of that, and if further is needed, we can provide you something more in-depth in writing for you to review. The committee process occurs both at the branch level, and we have committee processes that also occur at the central office level. We use committees when we are making determinations around the placement of sibling groups. We use committees when we are looking at making those very, very difficult decisions of leaving a child to be adopted by a current caretaker versus a child being adopted by a relative. We, as Ms. Foley mentioned in reference to foster care, the same holds true with the number of families available to service a child. When we move to look at the selection of a family, we hope to have 3 to 4 families to choose from, and we hope to be able to go forward with the committee so that they can have some options in selecting the family that can best meet the child's needs. Our committee members are folks who are not directly involved with the case, and that is so that the decision can be made from an objective stance. And as I've said, over the last many years, that process has worked very, very well, where these folks who are skilled and trained and have expertise in adoption, many of them have done the work themselves, will sit. Usually there's 3 to 4 members that comprise the committee, receive all of the information that is provided. Here is from the caseworker and the family as far as the needs of the child, and then review the various families that have been presented to make a determination as to who might be the most capable of meeting that child's needs.
Usually, Senator Carter and Representative Garrard, and correct me if I'm wrong, Angela, one of those individuals will not be a DHS employee. Mm-hmm. 2 of those people will be trained in adoption, all are trained in adoptions, but usually there's someone from the private sector that sits in. But as Angela says, the controversy is that meeting happens with those 3 folks, and then they come out, and there's a decision. And if people don't like the decision, then the challenge is this the best forum in which those kinds of very, very important decisions get made? And we're open to looking at that. And Angela, through her connections with the National Resource Center, they're going to provide that assistance to us for free. We're entitled to that because it's federally funded. And they're going to come in and just walk through that system and tell us whether or not that's the most efficient way, or there are things we should be less concerned about in terms of the privacy of the families. Over this past biennium, we've been working, Angela, since she came here, to kind of open this process up more to the court-appointed special advocates so they have a little bit more information, opening up a little more to the child's attorney. And so those are things that we're interested in. And again, what we're trying to balance is respect for the privacy of individuals going through that process and keeping it as a professional decision, not just an emotional decision. But we have had a lot of controversy around decisions generally, as she said, because you have somebody who has been caring for the child for several years, but you have a viable relative who also wants to care for the child. And those are very difficult decisions because the child will live with the result of that decision for the rest of their childhood and into adulthood.
Thank you, Ramona. And Angela, welcome to Oregon.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Thank you very much, Representative Garrard.
Senator Gordley. Thank you. Just to follow up, is it accurate to say that the practice that we're following now is a best practice?
Chair Carter, Chair Carter, Senator Gartley. Yes, it is a best practice. I would say committees are used in other states for the purpose of selecting an adoptive home.
Dr. Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're running out of time. First, I want to thank you for taking these two on. These are the two biggest issues I hear from in my district about these kind of issues, is these two problems, and they're very difficult. I can give you multiple cases, you know, cases where the dad's in jail, the mom can't be found, and tracking those people down and then getting them to agree to ending parental rights is just a huge, huge time-consuming battle for you, and I appreciate you looking at that. Maybe mediation would make it go faster. So I appreciate that very much, you doing both of these. These are very emotional and difficult issues, but they are the two biggest stumbling blocks I see in our area, at least, for this. The question I have for you is there a great variation amongst county to county, or is this sort of a uniform, these two issues, are they kind of uniform across the state?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I would say anecdotally it is occurring across the state. I don't know that we can pinpoint a particular area of the state where it's happening more or less, but I would say across the state. And when the National Resource Center comes, they will be here very soon in the next few weeks. They will be here within the first week of March, and we'll conduct focus groups with community members, focus groups with internal folks who are working with adoptions. They will also have the opportunity to observe a committee process at the branch level, a committee process at the central office level. They already have been forwarded copies of our rules, our statutes, everything related to this process so that they can be well-versed as to how it currently operates. And then what we're asking them to do, as Ms. Foley indicated, is to give us a very clear, sound, objective assessment of how this is working, and to also give us some feedback as to how it's operating in other states and where we might be able to tweak and modify it to get it to work a little bit more smoothly.
And Chair Carter and Senator Bates, I would just circle that conversation back around to what we started out talking about Monday, about having the need for a good model of practice that is consistent in all 36 counties, because counties don't just suddenly hit the decision for adoption. That decision is a process, and that process starts early on in the case. And if a county, for example, has a practice where they don't engage the relatives at the time the child comes into care, that creates a problem later. If the child can't go back to the birth family, then all of a sudden the relative's sitting out there and they haven't been treated what they consider fairly. So it really does circle back around into some consistency around using the model of practice. We shouldn't have the variation that we have, and that's one of the things we're going to try to move to with this model. But it also impacts the safety issues of children and adoption, and hopefully gives us better work in the case by the time the case, if the case does have to reach adoption.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just listening to the last couple of days of testimony, I mean, one of the things that I think is challenging about the system is the child state, there is one child who moves through this entire system, and at different entry points, there are different investments made. And I'm wondering if a flow chart might be, you know, when they enter at a report, they see one worker. They go to foster care, it's another worker. They go to adoption, it's another worker. There are different payments along the way. I think when we're trying to explain to the general public how the system works, understanding the flow chart, how it should be working, and where the investments are made along the line might be helpful for people. I don't know if you have something like that, but...
Chair Carter and Representative Cotet, we do have a two-pager, and the first page shows the process of a case coming in through the Child Protective Services phone line. And it walks through that case, little blocks along the way about the investment of other parts of the system, like the court system, for example. And then the second sheet of paper actually goes from the point a child enters foster care all the way through either the child going back home or the child going into adoption. And we'd be glad to furnish that document because it does give you a nice bird's eye view of all the pieces. We are working on the second issue you talked about, and that is how workers get assigned to cases. The fact that part of the premise behind child welfare work is you have consistency in the relationship. And if you don't have consistency in the relationship, it's much harder to move the case plan forward. So one of the things we're working on with this practice model is limiting the number of caseworkers that actually have to handle the case. You still have the front end. Child Protective Services becomes like your emergency room at a hospital. People that do that should do that all the time. But then a decision is made, and either a case is going to be opened or not. It's either going to be in-home services or it's going to be out-of-home services, foster care. And we're trying to limit the numbers of people that those cases get handed off to.
Thank you.
Madam Chair? Representative Bowman.
And this is a little off point, but I just wanted to suggest to people who don't live and breathe this subject every day, you might pick up a copy of White Oleander and find out how lucky we are in Oregon that our system is not like it was in the book.
Chair Carter and Representative Boone, I believe that was a southern system, so I'm not going to comment on that.
Yeah. It's also a good read.
It's California, isn't it?
Yeah, it's California.
It's California. It's a good movie, too. Scary.
Mr. Gordes? Thank you, Madam Chair. Aside from what we might hear later in testimony, public testimony, about our adoption system, our foster care placement system, and aside from what many of us as legislators hear from constituents who have strong sentiments about how well the system works or not, aside from that, is there a forum, or where is there a forum for citizens and organizations who have those concerns to be engaged with you, with the department? Does such a forum exist? I'm thinking about an organization in particular that I hear a lot from in my district. It's called Mother Interrupted, and I'm not sure if you're familiar. You are familiar. So where is that forum?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordon, I think the best answer I could give you is that we have under statute an advisory committee to child welfare in the state. It's a 21-member committee. Those individuals represent all kinds of child welfare. Private sector, OYA serves on that committee. Parents Anonymous is on that committee, and that committee meets every other month. It has a couple of subcommittees that meet, and those committee members are where you can bring forth any issues, policy issues, not so much case-specific. Case-specific generally will be filed as a grievance in the agency, or someone will contact the ombudsman's office and the director's office, and we will individually look at a case. But generally, the broader issues around child welfare come to that committee. That committee is very active. Judy Stiegler from Deschutes, who is the CASA director, there chairs that committee for us. And then several of us serve as resources to that statutory committee.
Great information. Thank you.
I want to say one. Obviously, Ms. Cause has had to have, she hasn't been in quite 6 months yet, very steep learning curve, but I want to compliment you for your presentation today and your knowledge. I'm just floored by how well you have fit into the system here, and appreciate that very much, and I hope that you will continue to find Oregon being a good place for you to stay. Thank you for the presentation today. Any other questions or comments before we dismiss? Committee adjourned.